It's time for the Pro Wrestling Time Tunnel Podcast.
We've got lots and lots of things to talk about and to do today.
Covering the territories from the 1940s to the 1990s.
It's the best thing going today.
Interviewing wrestlers, referees, authors, and other media personalities that have made the sport of professional wrestling great.
The cream, yeah. The cream of the crop.
And now, here's your host, Tony Richards.
Hey there, everybody. This is Tony Richards, and I want to welcome you to our Pro Wrestling Time Tunnel podcast. On our show, we're tracking and documenting the history of pro wrestling from its beginnings through 1990. With special emphasis on the 50s, the 60s, and the 70s pre-video era. We're profiling personalities by having the authors who've studied their lives and written their stories. We're studying and revisiting territories and the booking offices that control them. Historic towns where the history of pro wrestling is so deep, and the legendary buildings where the fans came to see their favorite stars and storylines play out virtually every single week. We're covering all four of these dimensions of the sport of pro wrestling, and I'm so appreciative you've decided to allocate some of your time to go on this journey with us through this show. If you like what we're doing, you might want to think about visiting my Substack channel by searching for Tony Richards 4, and there you can subscribe to my daily wrestling history newsletter, where you'll find birthdays of wrestlers past and present, an RIP salute daily to those in the business who we want to honor that have passed on, an event on that day in pro wrestling history, and much, much more. You'll also have an archive of this podcast and special updates on my Dory Funk Sr. book. All of that is provided for free. But I do have a special vault of writings for paid subscribers. And by subscribing to that, that helps support me and my research and the work to do all of this for you. You'll find it all on my Substack channel, substack.com. Search for Tony Richards 4 and the Pro Wrestling Time Tunnel. You can also follow me on X at Tony Richards 4 or join our Facebook group, Pro Wrestling Time Tunnel. Okay, with all that out there, let's go to today's show and today's guest. Hello again, everybody. Welcome to another Time Tunnel podcast. We cover pro wrestling's past here and talk about the history of pro wrestling. And we've been focusing in on the Tennessee, what we call the Tennessee Territory, with Nick Gulas and Roy Welch's organization that had a booking office in Nashville, Tennessee, and they ran cards in Tennessee, Kentucky, Indiana, Arkansas, Mississippi, sometimes Missouri. And a guy who knows a lot about that history is here with us today, Tim Deals, who has written some books with both Mark James and Scott Teal, who are the two authoritarians for Tennessee wrestling, as far as I'm concerned. And so thank you so much, Tim, for making time to come and visit with me today.
Thank you very much. Looking forward to this, and looked forward to it since we talked about it. And
good.
Well, I'm sure some of those other guys are much more qualified than I am, but hey, I love talking about it.
Hey, I'm glad to have you here. And this probably won't be the last time, but we're really focusing in on, well, let's start with your being a fan. When did you become a fan of wrestling?
Hard to tell. Probably late 60s. I was born in 1964. I'm 60 as we're talking now. And one of my earliest memories is watching the Scuffling Hillbillies chase somebody around the Chattanooga TV studio with a shotgun. And so I kind of would think that's probably around 68 or so. I also have another memory around that time of watching the Chattanooga TV show and Tojo Yamamoto being in the wrestling ring.
Mm-hmm.
And the way they frame this is just stuck in my mind forever. That he was in the ring and he had a wrist lock on somebody. The guy was on the mat and the referee would work his way around the two wrestlers, you know, make sure everything was kosher that was going on. And when the referee would get to Tojo's back, Tojo would begin to spread that guy's fingers. And I thought, what? This is the meanest man in the world.
Yeah. Terrible. And he's so, Japanese too.
Yes. So. And I could do that. And I knew how it felt. Right. You know? And so those are some of my earliest memories of watching wrestling, being around a lot. I had some family who loved it too.
Yeah. Well, I think the I narrowed it down to I think the first time I saw it was in 72, and I'm just a couple years older than you are. And we got I watched the Paducah, Kentucky television station, and we got the show that was recorded in Nashville. And I remember seeing that, and I was a big comic book guy when I would have been 9 years old in 72. And when I saw wrestling on TV for the first time, I thought, man, this is like a live action comic book. Like I, yes. You know, because of masked guys, you know, and all dressed up and everything. I thought, man, these are like superheroes in real life, you know.
All right.
And the colorful tights on the baby faces and all, and the ring jackets. And I thought, man, this is cool.
Yes.
And then I think my first card was in 74. And at the time, Phil Golden was running an outlaw promotion in Paducah. And I saw the Bass Brothers with Ma Bass.
Oh, wow.
At the live card. And she was the first. I saw Saul Weingroff on television, but she was the first manager I saw at a live card. And, man, was she a heat magnet. I mean,
I was going to say she was a live wire.
Oh, man. And, of course, I didn't know she used to be a wrestler, you know.
Right.
I thought she was Ma Bass, you know.
That's right.
And she had that loaded purse, and, man, she just got the crowd riled up, and they wanted to take her out back or something, you know. And it just, I don't know, I just loved it, you know.
Yeah.
And then, and so I'm fascinated by – I mean, I was pretty aware of what was going on from Nashville East, but the western part of the territory, I've been fascinated with that ever since I started studying the history, because I never saw any of that stuff. And all the different towns had their own television, so different booking took place in different parts, right? And so I'm interested in just that, you know, because I know – well, I'll just show these books. You've written a book called The Tennessee Record Book, where Mark James went out and located all these matches and cards for around the territory. And this is the 1973 to 1979 book, which I've been using for my research lately. And then the other one is the Tennessee Athletic Commission from 1935 to 1971. This is written with Scott Teal and yourself. And you were just telling me before we went on, there's going to be another one of these that comes out, right?
Yes. Not sure when, but got our fingers crossed.
Yeah, down the road, though. It gives us something to look forward to.
There you go. There you go.
So tell us a little bit about, let's talk about going back to referencing the commission book, a little bit about Roy Welch and Nick Gulas. You know, I am just fascinated and upset at the same time that Roy Welch is not in the Observer Hall of Fame. And just the impact that guy had on Southern wrestling, not just Tennessee. I mean, just about every state in the South he touched in some way. Tell us a little bit about Welch and Gulas.
Well, you know, I have never really pinpointed the exact date they came together. But they were around each other, or at least near each other, for years. I mean, Nick came to Nashville, what, around the late 30s, early 40s. And Roy had been in and out of the area for a long time. And Roy and his family ran a little territory. You talked about some towns in Arkansas and Missouri. Mm-hmm. They ran some of those towns for years up into Kentucky.
Oh, well, Roy and Herb were a big deal in Paducah. I mean, as a tag team, you know.
Yes. Caruthersville, Missouri is one of those towns that for years.
Hey, Ty.
I think Herb worked as Joe Welch there for whatever reason.
Yeah, I just saw a card. I just saw a card in Hayti, Missouri the other day.
Hayti, exactly. Yeah. They like ran it in an old post office building, probably. Mm-hmm. I think that might have been where they ran
in Sykeston and all those towns.
Yeah. And a lot of those towns were towns that Roy and his brothers ran. And then, of course, Nick came to Nashville in the late 30s and early 40s and began running there. And, you know, there were a few other folks that ran there for a while. But by the time the 40s moved on and we were coming into the 50s, Nick and Roy were a team and working together and had their hands and all over, like you said, all over the South. And Roy, interesting character. He was a dairy farmer. You know, he had a big dairy farm out there near Dyersburg. And Nick ran the show in Nashville. I know I'm like you, I've often wondered exactly about the Dyersburg office. There was a Dyersburg office, and exactly what they did, I don't know. I mean, I have a feeling that was just kind of Roy's stomping grounds, and that's what Roy did, and maybe ran some of those towns that I referenced earlier from with Herb.
I was I had an opportunity here about 3 years ago. I was making for my regular job, I was making some visits to some clients, and I was in Cape Girardeau, and I was going to Malden, Missouri, and then I was going to go over to Kentucky to see my parents. And the way to get there was to cross the bridge at Dyersburg. And I thought, I'm going to go through Dyersburg. I hadn't been to Dyersburg in years and years, but I had Roy on my mind. I'm like, man, I wish I knew where that office used to be.
Oh, I have the address somewhere. I don't know where it is, but I remember having an address for it at one time, and maybe on an old envelope or something. I'll dig it out and see if I can find it for you. But yeah, I'm glad to know that I'm not the only person who would do that. I would go out of my way to,
Oh, if I'd have known where his farm was, I'd probably gone by there too.
Exactly. I would have too. But those two guys put it together and ran a huge territory. I mean, when you look, I mean, we were talking. You talked a minute ago about some of the area that they covered, and when you if you look at that on a map, man, I mean, it's a
It's
huge
huge.
geographical area. And then at times they even dip down into toward the Gulf Coast at times in the early days, and they ran some shows in Jackson, Mississippi. At certain times, I think in the early 50s for a time, I think Roy ran down there.
Well, I was just reading in the brand new part two of Frankie Kane, the Frankie Kane book. They were talking about Roy and being in Florida, and Nick being down there helping out with some towns. I'm like, I didn't even know Roy did Florida, so.
You're right. I believe there was some. I've seen some down there. I can't recall the year. Probably
It
in the
was in the
50s
40s, I think.
or 40s. I wish I knew more about Roy. Roy's one of those guys that he wasn't out front. He was more behind the scenes and more dealt with more with the guys than he did with the fans. I did at one time ask the late Jerry Jarrett, tell me a little bit about Roy Welch, and got a little bit of information out there, because it's the same way. Everybody talks about Nick, and nobody talks about Roy, but there were
I'm in the
a
middle
few.
of writing a Dory Funk book right now, and so I'd uncovered that Roy had been an oil rig worker and worked with Dutch Mantell, the original Dutch
The
Mantell,
original, yeah,
and that's where he kind of broke in.
yeah, yeah. And that was probably some real salty days
Oh yeah,
in those
it was
West
pretty.
Tennessee oil fields.
Dutch Mantell,
And Dutch Mantell.
the original Dutch Mantell, and Cal Farley had shoot matches and got their teeth knocked out and all that kind of stuff,
And then put their arms around each other and went home.
Yeah, became partners.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right.
Yeah, I think that's how Roy and Dutch got to be close, is 'cause they were both tough old dudes, and they weren't old dudes at that time. They were real young men, but they were just tough birds, and they respected that. So, and then Nick, he got started in Alabama, I think, right? And
In
working
Birmingham.
for Chris Jordan, who was a promoter down there. And
Nick's family, outside of him, were mostly restaurant folks. They ran restaurant businesses, and even I'm in the Chattanooga area. I can recall coming to Chattanooga when I was a kid and driving by Gulas Restaurant, and I thought to myself, Gulas, that's the wrestling promoter,
Can't be
and
too many people named that, right? I mean, they must be
exactly, particularly in the Deep South, right?
right.
And And so Nick came from a big family. Most of them went into the restaurant business in Birmingham or Huntsville or Chattanooga and maybe Nashville. I think there was some on the Gulf Coast. But Nick broke from that and got into the wrestling business. And I found out at times also some of his brothers dabbled in the wrestling business as promoters, particularly Gus, who lived in the Hunt ended up living in the Huntsville area. And there were a couple of others who did, but yeah, I've often wondered too, what caused him to move to Nashville when he was in Birmingham. And I don't know if there was some sort of power struggle or whatever in Birmingham where he kind of got on the outs, or if he just said, I'm gonna try this on my own and went to Nashville and eventually made it there. I mean, when you're talking about going to Nashville and begin to work there. He worked in the wrestling business for 40 consecutive years. That's pretty amazing.
Right.
1980 he went out, and then even later he came back and ran some shows. Not quite as successful as before, but Nick was in the wrestling business as long as he lived. He still was promoting those shows.
Well, if his family were in the restaurant business, then that explains a lot about Nick's financial habits because, I mean, the restaurant business has got a thin profit margin. You got to
Right.
watch every penny, So I could see how Nick developed that, mindset.
Yes, absolutely.
However, I do hear story. I mean, you hear all the bad stories about Nick, but there are some good stories about he really took care of some guys that he really, that worked with him and that he cared about and that he trusted. And there were some good things about Nick too.
Sure. When you're in the business, you can find those reasons, I'm sure, just like you and I would in any kind of workplace. But he did give a lot of people a break, and he employed a lot of people for years. And sure, he may have screwed a few of them over here and there.
Well,
But,
that's always in the eye of the beholder, I mean,
yeah.
everybody's got a story.
Yeah.
Nobody likes
It,
the boss,
I was going to say, it's a different perspective when you're the one paying the bills
Right.
and you're the one responsible for paying everything. And the promoter, when you really examine it, and particularly in those days, the things they were responsible for, booking an arena, paying for an arena, all those expenses beyond just paying the boys, which is sometimes all that gets thought about, We're talking about the commission. You had commission licenses. You had commission taxes. Depending on where you're running, you might have had city taxes to pay on top of all these things. So, that money wasn't, particularly in those days, wasn't an endless pot. Especially in some towns where, as you said, the margin of making it or breaking it had to be really thin in some of those towns.
So, just thinking a little bit about what we were talking about a few minutes ago about the television, what towns had their own TV? So Nashville had a show that they did, I think, on Wednesdays, and then they had the card that night. And somebody was telling me that the other day. And then Ron Fuller, I've heard him tell the story two or three times. Like it about killed him when he first went around to do all the television, So where were all the television shows?
Since we're kind of focusing on 75, 50 years ago, in prep for this, I looked through some of the stuff, and I could see where they had studio TV shows in Louisville. We'll throw Knoxville in there, even though Ron Fuller is in the process of kind of taking that over.
But the
Nashville.
same talent, they were still booking talent. I mean, it was the same guys were working, both
Oh, yeah,
Johnson City
absolutely.
and Knoxville.
Yeah. You throw in Chattanooga. Jackson, Tennessee had a TV show in 75. Memphis had a TV show. Birmingham, Huntsville had a TV show. I don't know about Florence, Alabama. I don't know if they had their own. You mentioned Paducah. By that time, that might have been the Nashville show.
It was the
Bowling
Nash, yeah.
Green.
Yeah, now
Bowling Green, I'm not sure about either.
Paducah had their own studio show in the 60s.
Right.
But it was the bicycle tape by the 70s.
Yeah, and they were moving toward that. But when you think about that, the thing that blows my mind is the continuity that you would have to have just from, even if you didn't have to consider the TV show, if you had to consider from week to week booking these towns and what went on in this town this week, and we're going to do that in this town in 2 weeks or what have you. But then to throw TV in the mix and say, okay, this has to happen here. And I've got to have talent here at this time for this, but I need them here at this time for here, And there's some of the stories about some of those guys having to work Friday night in Knoxville and then get up and do the Knoxville TV show Saturday morning and then drive to Chattanooga and do the Chattanooga TV show in the afternoon, the Chattanooga house show. And then drive to either Huntsville or Birmingham and do a TV show there, all in one day,
Well, I
you
think
know?
in 75, Nick and Jarrett were kind of working together and doing the booking. So that even complicates it more when you got two guys working on it. And Jerry, I'm sure, was booking Louisville and Evansville for sure, and Memphis. But he would be working in a card in Knoxville, which was probably booked by Nick, or he would be in Birmingham, which was probably booked by Nick. So I figured, he probably had like, there would usually be, you just put two and two together, like Eddie Marlin would be in Louisville, or he'd be in Evansville. So you kind of can think, well, he was probably running it on site, for Jerry. And I don't know when Christine started. I don't know if that was after the split or if she was involved before it or how that worked.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, she's heavily involved in the actual office, for years and years, but where she actually was a promoter or actually went on the road, I don't really know. One of the things that amazes me too about talking about all these separate TV shows in all these separate towns, by this time in the 70s, you talked about a tape being bicycled. Other territories had figured this out, right? There had been a time in the Carolinas where you had all sorts of different TV shows as well, and maybe in Florida and in Georgia. But by 75, most of these territories had figured out we're going to tape on this date, and then we're going to send the tape around, right? But that still hadn't happened here for the most part.
Yeah, by 75, I think Charlotte was doing Raleigh. And they were taping, the guys had Wednesday off. The only thing they did was television. And then they took that television tape and then did interviews for everything else. And that's how they did their television. And they had that same, they had a television in High Point, they had one in South Carolina. They kind of had the Tennessee model, but then throughout the 70s, they slowly but surely scaled it down to the bicycle model.
And eventually that happened here, but at this time, you still see this. And I think it's amazing when we talk about so many of those towns. I'm not as familiar with Louisville, but some of those other towns I'm familiar with and some of the people who work there. Jim Hess in Knoxville before Ron Fuller took it over and kicked him out. And Harry Thornton in Chattanooga and Ron Lowry was the guy in Jackson, Tennessee, starting Brewer in Birmingham and Grady Reeves and Huntsville, all those guys were old radio guys who
Yeah.
had been in the business for a long time.
Well, Lance was.
And Lance and Dave, and they had instant credibility because of their longevity in radio first, for the most part, for most of those guys, and then into television. So when Harry Thornton came on your TV on Saturday afternoon in Chattanooga, you knew who he was. So let me sit down and see what he says here. And so what? He wasn't the greatest in the world, but he was local. He didn't have to worry about that tape going on the USA Network later on and people criticizing him for not knowing what he's doing. All he had to do was tell people, you come to the auditorium tonight and you're going to see a Pier 6 brawl.
Yeah, there
And
weren't
that's all these
even
guys had to do, and they were great at it.
yeah, there weren't even guys in the state of Tennessee that were watching it. I mean, it was just the people in Chattanooga and the
Yeah.
surrounding area. I
Yeah.
mean, the people in Nashville didn't know what was going on in Chattanooga.
No. No.
And what
No.
really bothers me, Tim, I can't think about it too much because it really bothers me, but we don't have any of those tapes
Oh, I
of
know.
all of that stuff. I mean,
No.
in Louisville, you mentioned Louisville in 72. I know George Gulas and Len Rossi did the show.
Yeah.
And then George got in the ring after that in 73. And after Len's wreck, I think he and George started. I don't know who did it before that.
Jim Cornette might know. I've seen very little of it from then. I know the tape you're talking about. That's a great tape. You know, I love watching that. And I'm like, hey, maybe there's hope that there's more out
Yeah,
there.
they're just
I
lining up fans to talk to on that.
know, isn't
So,
that
yeah. And I can remember that happening.
Yeah.
I can't remember that I saw it at the time, but I can remember the doing that even on the Nashville show.
Yes, I can recall them doing it on the Nashville show as well when I saw it. Being in Chattanooga, growing up, we would see on occasion, for instance, if Chattanooga ran weekly for many years, but they didn't run every week. They generally ran probably 48 or 50 shows a year. Every now and then, something would come in and occupy the auditorium and kick them out for a week, like maybe the home show. And so maybe on that week when there was no house show in Chattanooga that week, they might ship in the Memphis TV show because why send a bunch of guys down to Chattanooga when we could use them somewhere else? Or they would show the Birmingham show or the Nashville show. So every now and then you did get to see a little bit of what was going on somewhere else. Not often. And then around this time too, we're beginning to see some of the highlights from the house shows that begin to appear. I'm so glad we have some of those.
Oh, yeah.
I'm like you though. I wish we had some of those TV studio matches. I worked in television in Chattanooga for a few years, and I can remember going, I wonder where the tape library is, and coming to find out there's not one, right? Not a very big one anyway. Because, how are you going to house everything and how are you going to record
They
everything?
just kept using about three tapes over and over. But
Oh.
even, I sometimes bothers me that people call it Memphis wrestling because there was so much more to it than that. But after the split, because the show was done in Memphis and bicycled, all the major happenings were centered around Memphis. And even some of the things that happened in not so much Louisville. Louisville was pretty much a repeat the next week of Memphis, but in Evansville, there were some different things that happened, and they would either tape it on the local insert, or they would, for instance, like when Terry Funk came in to do his angle with Lawler in Evansville, Indiana, it was a tag match with Dory Jr. came in, but
No.
you would never know that or see that because it's not on the Memphis tape, if that makes sense.
And that's the thing about what we call the Memphis tapes, the Memphis Library, is some of it's Memphis, most of it's Louisville. You might get a Nashville tape every now and then and an Evansville tape. There's maybe a few more Evansville out there, but there's very few of the actual Memphis tapes that survived. It's usually those 1 hour shows that got shipped around.
Yeah, there's a handful of 90-minute ones from Memphis. What's your most vivid memory of Tennessee? Or maybe in your research, what intrigues you the most about what you've been able to find?
Well, I've always been fascinated, I guess, at the split that happened in 77. And you wonder about some things, how, when you look at things and you read things, for instance, one of the great things about present time is we can research old newspapers online. You don't have to go to a library to do that anymore in most cases. And so you go online and you would look up some stuff about this split that happened in March of 1977. And you read some stuff, and I think I did an interview with Jerry Jarrett one time, and he talked about turning his resignation in on, a month before he actually began promoting. And I just wanted to go, really? It only took you a month to put all that together, And I always wonder, really, when did it happen? When did that split happen? Because when you go back and you look, Jerry disappeared for a few months in the late last end of 1976, and was he just on the outs, or was he sitting around going, how do I get back in, or what do I do? And there are answers out there, but I just often wonder, is there more
Well,
out
you
there?
know, and I've been posting stuff from April of 75 in my Facebook group. Well, a guy contacted me the other day and he goes, "Hey," he goes, "there's Jerry Jarrett and George Gulis tagging up together."
Yes.
He said, "I thought that was when the split happened. I thought that was what caused the split." I said, "Well, it may have been, but it took a while. You know, it wasn't just something that happened in 77. I mean, George
It had to
started."
build.
Yeah, it was going on. And I also, this is not a popular opinion, but when I was watching George back in those days, I didn't think he was all that bad. I mean, people talk about now like he's the world's worst wrestler. And well, when you were a fan watching television in 1975, I didn't think he was that bad.
Exactly. I had that same discussion with a longtime fan who was a little bit older than me, and I said something about, in the context of the time, I didn't think George was that bad. He was one of the good guys. That's who you were supposed to cheer for. So that's who I rooted for. Well, how dare you? And I'm like, yeah, but you got to look at it. And when I'm looking at it from this perspective in 75, not looking at a 1975 tape in 1993.
Or just thinking about it or hearing about it, because you tend to truncate it down to just a few facts instead of watching it day, week in and week out as a fan. I don't think. I don't, unfortunately, and I'm not cutting down the generations or anything like that, but I think it's hard for people to really, really understand what it was like if you weren't there. Because it was an entirely different world.
I mean, I don't watch the product much today. I turn it on and I'm baffled. I don't understand a lot of it anymore. It's passed me by, maybe. And just like maybe some from today's generation will look at that stuff and go, ugh, terrible. It's the same thing with thinking about the Harry Thornton. Oh, he's a terrible announcer. Well, in the context of what he had to do when he had to do it was perfectly fine what he did.
I was watching, and this made me laugh, but it was a guy who obviously, and I think your wrestling of your childhood is always your favorite wrestling,
It
right?
is, yes.
And there's a guy posted and he goes, "Man, it was so cool when Sting came out with RoboCop." And I thought that was where I got like disenchanted with it. Like that's where I went, "I can't watch, this is crazy, you know." But there's people that that's their favorite thing, you know? But for me, it was like, I can't invest in this at all, you know?
One of the other things you were talking about, one of the memories, or one of the things I'd like to find out a little bit more about, is really also prior to the split, is when did Roy Welch begin to leave the business? Now, Roy died in September of 77, and I think he was 75 at the time. With Jerry Jarrett's ascension into more of a leadership role in the company that took place in the late 60s and end of the 70s, Roy seemed to disappear even more. And,
Well, Roy
you
had,
know,
and I've always thought, Tim, sorry to interrupt you, but
no.
I've always thought that was Roy's doing. Like, I think Roy was the guy that made Jerry have that ascension. Like, I think
I agree.
Roy was all for it, I thought.
I think so too. I think there might have been some issues on it, maybe later on, maybe between them or what have you. But I think you're right. I think Roy was ready to move on. Interesting though, if that's the case, if Roy was moving on, boy, they sure continue to use his name. They used that the Roy Welch name until he died, really. It was a Nick Gulas Roy Welch show.
Well, as we
Or
were saying earlier, the Welch name meant something. I
it
mean,
did.
those guys had been around since the 40s. I mean, as wrestlers. And so people identified wrestling with the Welch name.
Yes. And even when Buddy Fuller hooked up with Jerry Jarrett, a lot of those cards you would not see Buddy Fuller's name, but you would see the name Edward Welch, which is his given name, and that's that Welch name being stuck out there again.
Well, a couple of my buddies have gone into these pushes to get guys in the Hall of Fame. One friend of mine, he's really pushing for Morris Siegel to get in, and has done a great job continuing to increase the votes for him. And I want to get Roy in. You know,
I agree.
I think he needs to be in there.
I agree. The longevity, you think about the family members that would not have been in the business had Roy not been in the business. I mean, and that goes from his brothers who were major stars, particularly Herb and Lester. Jack was a little more less known, but Herb was the workhorse of that Welch family for years. And Lester did the same in the 50s and the 60s. And then they were all involved, every one of them, Jack included, in the promotional end of the business for years. You throw in the Golden family. Bill, you talked earlier about Bill or Phil Golden,
Bill and
but
Phil.
Bill Golden, they married into that family, or Bill married into that family, so they were related to them. Then you've got all the cousins, got the Hatfields, the Fields family. So many of these folks were such a part of wrestling day to day for decades in Tennessee, in Alabama, down on the Gulf Coast, spreading out into Louisiana, and into Florida. And then when you stop and think about it, some of the other big players in the game were partners with the Welch family at various times. Eddie Graham, who, has his good points and bad points, but so many people respect him as having such a brilliant mind in the business. Well, he paired himself with the Welch family at various times, with Buddy Fuller and with Lester Welch and the Jim Barnetts of the world, who also had that. They were involved with the Welch family as well. And much less you talk about what Ron Fuller did in with a couple of different promotions over the years, and Robert Fuller as a booker, and so many others. I mean, just from the standpoint of putting so many people in the business who made an impact, much less the impact he made on himself as being a major star consistently for years. And I get tired also of hearing this stuff. Well, he was only in one territory. He didn't need to be anywhere else.
Well, I mean, yeah. I
You
mean,
draw for 40 years. What more do you want? If you can draw for 40 years, hey,
yeah, if you were
that's your,
successful, you were successful. You know, I mean, that's the
And
bottom line.
that's the argument that's often used for Ole Anderson, right? He only worked Atlanta. Well, he worked more than that, but look what he did.
Yeah, I totally agree with you. I mean, there was a time where Buddy was in Louisiana, and he was also promoted in Arizona. And I think Lee Fields might have purchased Louisiana from Roy back there years ago before the McGurks and all that, you know, got involved. But it's quite a journey when you start looking into all this, you know.
Well, yeah, and you look at Roy too. We were talking earlier about his early days with the original Dutch Mantell. How many folks that are up for a Hall of Fame can go back that far?
Yeah, right.
And there's not that many left, and it's a shame that some of these guys aren't recognized for what they are, and it's just because a lot of people don't know their story.
The other thing that impresses me about Roy so much is that he went into these towns as a wrestler and he developed them. You know, he developed the town and built it to where he could promote it. And then he consolidated all of that stuff, you know, and integrated it all. And this was in the 40s and 50s, and You know, there were booking offices, but there weren't really what you'd call territories, you know, and so he was one of the first to kind of put that together, you know.
Yes, that's a good point, because we were talking earlier about some of those towns that he ran, and it was a circuit he ran, you know, Caruthersville and Dyersburg and some of those towns. When you look at those consistently through a year, you do see that pattern go on of these towns that are running these shows, and Roy's the one behind them. He's the one running them.
Yeah, in my funk research, I mean, in Amarillo, there was a booking office in Amarillo. There was one in El Paso. There was one in Albuquerque, and all that. And then somebody came along and consolidated all that and made it into a territory out of Amarillo. And that's the way wrestling was in the 30s and 40s. Every town kind of had its own office, you know.
Right. And it developed into really what Roy came along with, where it was more regional or territorial or statewide,
And there
which
was
made sense.
no television, so there it was radio and newspaper, you know. So that made it even tougher to build that promotion, you know.
And that may be part of the reason that Roy's not known as well, too, because so many of his glory years in the ring, in his early days as a promoter, there's not that stuff out there on media other than newspaper. And you got to dig through that. You got to find it. And you got to, I mean, you know, you got to put it in context. You got to pull it out and look at it from week to week to week. And often not just one city, but compare it, you know, add other cities into it as well, which is one of the things I love about doing the research, is I love, you know, picking through a town and looking at it for a year. But then when I throw in another town, like I've got a file open here of 75, and you know, the first show of the year that I have is Nashville. Well, that's great. Next town I got's Evansville, and then Jackson, Tennessee. When I begin to look at those things, you know, I begin to see some booking patterns, and I begin to see some other things that make it make a little more sense to me, other than just a card that I'm reading, wondering what went on there, you know.
Yeah, because you almost have to look at the town horiz or vertically in a from a calendar standpoint to see how they booked that town. Because back then, I mean, when in the 80s, when wrestling became more regional and national, they just did a lot of the same matches in every town, like because it was a widespread area. But back the thing, one of the things I love about the 70s is a region wasn't booked, a town was booked. So Chattanooga had its own matches and programs. Knoxville had its own. Jackson had its own. Nashville had its own. Memphis had its own. And they booked the town, not the territory, even though the territory was part of it, and they were coordinating all these guys moving around. They were booking 6 weeks in Nashville, and then they booked 6 weeks in Jackson. And that was one of the big things that kind of stuck out at me, like, wow, this is pretty interesting.
It's fun to look at, you know, say a card that took place, a program that ran for, you know, a month in a particular town. And then maybe 6 weeks later, you see them started in another town. You know, you got the interns jump Jackie Fargo, and so the interns and the Fargos are going to wrestle, and they work a 4 week program in Evansville, maybe. And then you look after the 4 weeks, maybe a couple of weeks later, you see it happen in Chattanooga. You know, it worked. Let's see if it works here.
And one of the things that's going on there in 75, if you look at a year, 50 years ago, is that Luke Graham is in as the top heel in the territory. Well, in I think in Chattanooga and Knoxville, a couple of those towns on the eastern end, they ran the angle where he put up a performance bond that he wouldn't turn on Jackie Fargo. And the Jackie and Luke were tag team partners, and people were trying to figure out, well, how's that happen? Well, if you don't have the newspaper, you don't know how they booked it, you know.
And I remember that angle. I remember watching that angle, because Luke had been such a bad guy, you know, with the thumb that he would jab in there, and he had a partner named Don Duffy for a
Don
time.
Duffy, yep.
And never, I mean, I know Don Duffy worked for years, but this might have been one of his biggest runs ever with Luke, because they drew some big houses in Chattanooga at the time, for sure. But after seeing that and Luke being so crazy in some of the matches against Fargo, and then a few weeks later, I think it's Randy Tyler and Rocket Monroe maybe did something to Luke and caused him to be upset, and Luke goes to the announcer and goes, "I gotta have a partner, and the only partner I think I can have that can help me beat these guys is Fargo." And you're going, "What?" And then he does the thing, "Well, I'll put up money that I won't turn on," and you're going, "Wow, this is gonna be something to see."
Right. Yeah, that's exciting. I just get excited hearing about it.
Yeah.
I wish I could go back and see it all. I wish we had it on tape, you
I
know.
do too. I do too.
Well, one of the things when I was talking to Alan Moore the other day, which is a mutual friend of ours, he was saying that after the split happened with Jerry, Chattanooga was probably the town that was Nick's best town. That
Yeah.
Nick kept drawing pretty well. Jerry couldn't crack it. And Nick, he was saying that the fan base was loyal to Nick in Chattanooga.
Yeah, they were. And when you really look at the towns and how they split, Jerry ended up with Memphis and Louisville and Lexington and Evansville, and some of those went. He ended up with Jackson at that time, and then Nick had Nashville, Birmingham, Chattanooga, Huntsville. So they both had, the same number of towns. But man, you could draw more in Memphis than you could in Nashville. I mean, they were putting 6,000, 8,000 in that Coliseum every week in Memphis. Well, the Fairgrounds Arena might draw 4,000, at tops. Chattanooga, if you filled it up, drew 6,000. But if you drew a full house in Memphis of 11,000, the best you're going to draw on the territory is probably 6,000 in Chattanooga. For Nick, would be 6,000 in Chattanooga or 6,000 in Birmingham, maybe 1,000 in Huntsville. And then when you're not drawing those crowds, you're drawing, a smaller number each week. It really does not work. But in 78 is when Jerry tried to come into Chattanooga and run. At the same time, Nick was trying to run Louisville.
Right. And
And
Jerry was the most popular wrestler ever in the city of Louisville.
yeah, exactly. And so I can recall Jerry coming in to Chattanooga, running his TV show, and I was very excited to see it because, here I hadn't seen Lawler and Dundee and some of those guys in a while. They had Jimmy Valiant. They brought Jimmy Valiant in and Joe Leduc. And I think that was part of the reason too that they didn't draw here was some of those guys nobody here knew. And Nick threw everything at the wall that summer to win that war, and he did. He had. I'd have to go back and look at some of the guys that were there. Ripper Collins, who was just a hoot to watch, and
Right.
Dutch Mantel and Ken Lucas were in, and some of those guys that were really talented,
Well,
underrated at the time. And
were Dutch and Savage having their program then, or was that after
I
that?
think that was after. I don't know that Randy was here then. But even after the split, Nick had his moments where they had some really good talent come through. I mean, Randy Savage, Dutch Mantell, the older Dutch Mantell,
The
that
Free
was,
Birds.
the Freebirds, exactly. Very young team. Then you had those young guys who were just starting, like Ricky Morton, Robert Gibson,
Bobby Eaton.
Bobby Eaton. Wow, just tremendously talented group of guys that were still here, mixing in with some guys that you wouldn't want to mess with, like Tojo Yamamoto and Gypsy Joe
And Jackie stayed
and
with Nick
Jackie.
too. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well,
And
when you think about it, and I can understand Nick's mindset because he's sitting there thinking, man, I've done this for 35 years. I know what I'm doing. This young guy, Jared, he's going to go out and do this, and he's probably not going to make it. And then he's going to have to come back to me. But
yeah.
really, Nick was better off if they hadn't split because
Yes.
he was
Yes.
getting a large chunk of money on the other side of the territory that he didn't really have to do much
Right.
to get, you know,
Right. All
and
you
we,
had to do, all you had to do on his side was just be consistent
yeah.
on the east side. All you had to do was be consistent. And in place, a city like Chattanooga would be consistent. It would draw consistently. And it was probably Nick's, from the records that I've seen with the Tennessee Athletic Commission from the late 70s, attendance-wise, if you can believe those records, which I
Well,
tend to.
it's got to be in the ballpark
Yeah,
somewhere.
it's got to be close. Chattanooga probably did draw a few hundred more per average on week than Nashville did. And is what causes that? I don't. Is it the product? Is it
Well, there's so many more entertainment options in Nashville.
exactly,
I mean, there were a
exactly.
lot more things for people to do than there were in Chattanooga.
Yeah,
You know, I
and
mean,
that's.
in 74, you had a brand new Opryland come in.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, there was just a lot more stuff.
Yes.
I would think, you know, that
Yeah.
there's a lot more competition for the dollar in Nashville.
I agree. I agree. I think one of the things that I really enjoy looking at is a town like Chattanooga or Knoxville, like I looked at. And you really do look at things like that where there was a time in Knoxville, probably in the 40s, maybe the 50s, where one of the newspaper columnists was lamenting how the weekly wrestling show in one night drew more fans than a three-night stand of the minor league baseball team.
Wow.
It shouldn't be this way. We should have, 2,000 a night at the ball game, but you didn't. And what caused that? I don't know. There was some consistency there. There was some work that had to be done by the promoters there to get folks out. Pre-TV days, and you did it, as you said earlier, through the newspaper generally,
Right.
maybe some radio, but usually it was newspaper.
Well, Tim, thank you so much for joining me today. I've loved this conversation. I could do this several times a week.
No, I appreciate that, Tony. I've enjoyed it. You're a good host. I appreciate you making me feel at home.
You bet. And I want you to come back sometime and we can continue this conversation. And I appreciate all the work you've done. I've enjoyed reading a lot of it and diving into it. And you're helping us document the history. And there's other people out there that appreciate it that you'll never know, you
Well,
know.
I appreciate that. And we're getting fewer and fewer out there that remember those days. So if you're out there, you share those memories with the rest of us before we're all gone. We want to hear.
And there's more younger people that care about it than you think. I mean,
Yeah.
that are discovering every day some stuff that they just kind of are fascinated by.
Yeah.
All right, Tim Deals, everybody. I will be back with another podcast here soon on the Time Tunnel Pro Wrestling History Podcast. My guest has been Tim Deals, and we'll join you again later. Well, I hope you enjoyed sitting in on our visit today, taking a trip back in the Pro Wrestling Time Tunnel. Hey, visit my Substack channel at TonyRichards4. Subscribing to my newsletter helps support the work I do to preserve pro wrestling history. Plus, you get it in your email inbox every single morning, and you never miss an issue of the newsletter or a podcast if you have a free subscription. If you have a paid subscription, that supports my work even more, and you'll get special stuff in the vault. Updates on my Dory Funk Senior book, which is coming along really, really nicely. I'm close to the end of the research phase and about to start the writing phase later on this fall. I appreciate your investment of time in our show today, and I hope you like and subscribe our podcast and our newsletter. And until next time, bye-bye, everybody.
Thanks for tuning in to the Pro Wrestling Time Tunnel Podcast. Tune in for another great episode next week, interviewing wrestlers, referees, and media personalities that have made the sport of professional wrestling great. Be sure to follow us on Facebook at Pro Wrestling Time Tunnel. We'll release a new episode soon. Don't you dare miss it.